This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, March 21st, 2003, from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. I'm Deepa Fernandez. The US begins their so-called shock and awe aerial bombardment of Iraq. We go to the ground in Iraq, Turkey, and Jordan. As worldwide protests continue against the war in Iraq, we go to massive Palestinian demonstrations in Ramallah. And the US Congress continues to work on a budget resolution for 2004. But first, these news headlines.
Massive aerial assaults continue to rock Baghdad as U.S. and British forces push northward from the Kuwaiti border. Meanwhile, U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld told reporters today that Iraqi leaders are, quote, losing control of their country. Sholene Espinoza is with U.S. forces in Iraq.
There has been evidently some defections or surrenders, if you will, of some senior Iraqi leadership, and that has led to some intelligence that obviously helps the military. I have watched the plans and watched the flexibility of the United States Marine Corps as essentially from the very get-go, the plan sort of, you know, got thrown out the window and they had to adapt. Saddam Hussein did an excellent job of attempting to put up roadblocks and barriers for the Marine Corps, bombing routes that they were going to take. He was able to accomplish a lot of things that our intel did not perhaps pick up. Also, the roads, we've had to go off-road where there have been minefields and we've been in danger of hitting mines because the main roads he has put roadblocks on.
Free Speech Radio News reporter Sholene Espinoza with U.S. forces in Iraq. French President Jacques Chirac said today he would stand against any retroactive U.N. blessing for the U.S.-led war on Iraq or any resolution that gave Washington and London post-war administration over the country. Nick Champeau reports from Paris.
President Chirac said he regretted the action undertaken by the United States and Britain because bypassing the United Nations means breaching international law. Speaking at the end of an EU summit in Brussels, the French leader said he would oppose a UN resolution which would hand over to Washington and London the task of rebuilding Iraq. The strongest anti-war voice in the West added that the UN was the only legitimate framework to rebuild peace there and elsewhere. France also refused to expel Iraqi diplomats from France, which the U.S. had requested. Meanwhile, the French population strongly condemns the U.S. strikes on Baghdad. 80,000 protested near the U.S. embassy in Paris, and a massive anti-war demonstration is scheduled in the French capital tomorrow afternoon. Nick Champeau, Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
Turkey has agreed to allow U.S. aircraft to fly over its territory for a war with Iraq. Two corridors will be opened for the American planes. Aaron Glantz reports from Turkey.
The Turkish parliament approved the overflights, but none have taken place yet. Turkish authorities are concerned the United States could airlift troops directly into northern Iraq, empowering the 20 million Kurdish people there. The Turkish army already has tens of thousands of troops in northern Iraq, and tens of thousands more are poised to enter Iraq on the command of the Turkish army. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Diyarbakir, southeastern Turkey.
Anti-war protests continue to rage throughout the world, especially in the Middle East. Thousands of demonstrators have clashed with police in Egypt, Yemen, Jordan, and Syria, among other countries. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Raphael Kraft reports from Syria.
There were no more than a few hundreds yesterday afternoon to demonstrate in the streets of the Syrian capital, Damascus. Syrian police almost outnumbered the demonstrators. Demonstrations are rare, even if this time the anti-war stance taken by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is shared by most of Syrian population. In November, Syria voted for Resolution 1441. The regime also ordered Muslim clerics to moderate their preaches in the mosques. 12 years ago, Syria took part militarily in the international coalition to oust Iraqi forces out of Kuwait. Although Iraq has always been Syria's traditional enemy, relations improved in between the two countries in the last years, especially on the economical level. Despite UN sanctions on Iraq, Syria also reopened the pipeline linking Iraq to the Syrian Mediterranean petroleum terminal. Fearing being isolated, both economically and politically in the region in the post-Saddam Hussein era, Damascus is trying to secure its position toward Western countries by redeploying some of its troops from Lebanon or by organizing parliamentary elections, but non-democratic ones. Human rights activists consider these measures as smoke screens and hope for real change.
Free Speech Radio News reporter Raphael Kraft in Damascus. Those are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. I'm Max Pringle.
And a few minutes ago, the air war in Iraq began.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld announcing that the U.S. has officially begun their so-called shock and awe aerial bombardment of Iraq. Explosions have reverberated in downtown Baghdad. There have been great columns of smoke shooting into the night sky as cruise missiles and warplanes dropped bombs over the capital city. Rumsfeld addressed the nation.
Coalition military operations are focused on achieving several specific objectives: to end the regime of Saddam Hussein by striking with force on a scope and scale that makes clear to Iraqis that he and his regime are finished.
Shock and awe is the phrase that the military is using to describe a campaign that's intended to use overwhelming air superiority to deliver a devastating blow that will break the Iraqi military both militarily and psychologically.
Chris Hellman is with the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C. He says such an intense bombardment is aimed to blitz the Iraqi military.
The first thing that you see is their air defense network is in pretty poor shape to the extent that it exists at all. On the ground, what we've seen is the U.S. military and the British moving across southern Iraq at really quite amazing speed. And I think what that tells us is that to the extent that they're even present in the region, the Iraqi military is offering very little resistance.
FSRN reporter Garish Schweitzer is traveling with the U.S. troops as they move into southern Iraq from Kuwait, yet he raises concerns for the ability of the troops to function as they've had very little sleep.
We just spent 18 hours in our vehicle straight driving, and so no one has slept. And a lot of this drive last night was done with night vision goggles because they didn't want to have headlights on to give away any sort of location as they crossed the border. So that's equally wearing and taxing, as there was a lot of stop and go in these very, very long convoys.
Senior researcher at the World Policy Institute in New York, William Hartung, says shock and awe combined with exhausted troops makes for a humanitarian disaster.
I think there's a huge contradiction in the Bush administration strategy for this war. On the one hand, President Bush says they want to limit civilian casualties. On the other hand, their opening salvo for the war is 3,000 cruise missiles, precision munitions, really unprecedented mass bombing, and a lot of it is going to be in and around urban areas. So by definition, you're going to be killing civilians either in the initial blasts or because, once again, you're going to be undermining Iraq's already fragile infrastructure, which has been suffering from 10 to 12 years of sanctions and war already.
Hours ago, U.S. Central Command confirmed the death of two U.S. Marines during today's attack. Yet in terms of the civilian casualties from such an intensive bombing campaign, Hartung says it will be a while before anyone will really know any precise death toll.
What it's going to be hard to find out from the mainstream media is how bad is that damage going to be initially, because a lot of these porters either are somewhere back from the lines or they're embedded with particular units where they're kind of almost an adjunct to those units. They don't really have independent ability to maneuver, independent perspective. I think it may take us some days or weeks to know how much damage is being done to civilians in Iraq by this initial huge bombing campaign.
Meanwhile, reports have also emerged that Iraqi oil wells are ablaze, though at this stage it's unclear who is responsible for the destruction. Some press is reporting that Iraqi troops set fire to the oil wells, yet there's no confirmation on this. Meanwhile, further reports say Iraq launched a missile attack on its southern neighbour Kuwait for a second day running, though this too remains unconfirmed. And as shock and awe is underway, Iraqi refugees have already begun to flee. Along the Turkish borders, Turkish troops have turned away Kurdish refugees, while camps along the Jordanian border have already accepted some 400 Iraqis today. Ula Al-Farawati reports from the Jordanian-Iraqi border.
At least 400 people have crossed the Iraqi-Jordanian cross point today into the border town of Urweshit. They are to be temporarily accommodated for a maximum of 7 to 2 hours in special refugee camps until they are sent to their home countries. 250 Sudanese who fled a U.S.-led military attack on Iraq spend the night here, and they are now on their way back to their home country. Rahmatullah is a Sudanese worker who spent 13 years with his family in Iraq. He was sitting in a bus that will take him and his family to Sudan.
Iraq is in a state of war, and we did not feel safe staying there. I am, God willing, going back to Sudan. Yesterday, when the first attack started, we were far away. We heard the sirens. It took us 7 to 8 hours to reach the border. We were afraid all the way that a missile would strike us. I am very afraid, but we wanted to save our lives. We did not expect this war. I am both happy and sad. I am happy I will get to see my family, but I am sad I am leaving a country where I worked for 13 years, leaving with nothing. I only have the clothes on me now because I was in such a rush to save my wife and children.
The United Nations announced Friday there were no huge influxes from Iraq, but added that the borders with neighboring countries Jordan, Syria, Kuwait, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Iran remain open. Anis Tarabe works with the relief agency CARE.
We're establishing now the tents in this camp in order to receive the Iraqi refugees. Actually, until now, we're thinking about 10,000 people could be accommodated in this camp.
A greater exodus is expected in the coming few days when the battle hots up. Meanwhile, Iraqi nationals are finding it hard to flee their country, as a few very expensive transportation means are available to take them the 600 kilometers highway from the capital Baghdad to the Jordan-Iraq border. Tarabe points out that it was not easy to prepare to accommodate the refugees.
And it's a very sandy area, so it's like for workers in terms of erection of tents, it's taking them more time because it's sandy and the wind is very hard.
Layla is a Sudanese student who spent 3 years in an Iraqi university studying to become a vet. She said the university in Baghdad refused to give her any of the needed papers to prove she successfully finished 100 credit hours. She added that she will have to start right from the beginning in a Sudanese university.
I am very sad. I don't know whether I will be able to finish my studies, but I am sure that I already lost the efforts of the past 3 years.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ola Farawati near the Jordan-Iraq border.
As the U.S. warplanes continue to bomb Iraq from Kuwait and aircraft carriers stationed in the Persian Gulf, the head of the Turkish army gave the final okay for U.S. warplanes to cross his country and initiate northern bombing runs. This on the biggest holiday of the year for Turkey's Kurdish minority population. From Diyarbakir, Aaron Glantz reports.
Tens of thousands of people stand swaying like the wind in a giant parade ground on the outskirts of Diyarbakir, the largest Kurdish-majority city in Turkey. It's Nevroz, the most important day on the Kurdish calendar, commemorating a Kurdish victory centuries ago against the King of Persia. With the start of the war, Nevroz celebrations in many Turkish cities have been banned this year. Here in Diyarbakir, multiple security checkpoints greet all festival-goers. This man is a peddler.
They controlled for their passports. They take the electric wires we use to make flags. Why do they take them?
Women festival goers were subject to heavier scrutiny, and pregnant women were searched the most for bombs. Women were forced to fully display each of their layers of clothes in a manner many found humiliating. Despite the presence of thousands of police, the celebrations went off peacefully, though attendance was down by almost half of last year. Seda is a student.
It's because of the war. People have taken refuge in their villages. The festival is not as big as the last time. It's also not that cheerful.
While Kurds celebrated their spring holiday, the Turkish cabinet and army leadership were working behind closed doors, putting the final touches on the terms under which U.S. warplanes will be allowed to cross Turkish airspace on their way to bomb Iraq. The Turkish parliament voted yesterday to allow the overflights, but none took place last night because the country's leadership didn't give its final approval. Turkish authorities want to say on what type of airplanes use Turkish airspace, and there are some reports Turkish authorities want to individually approve each bombing run. Turkish authorities are also concerned about the possibility of American military plans to airlift thousands of troops over Turkey directly into Kurdish-controlled northern Iraq. The government in Ankara wants to do everything it can to stop a Kurdish state from being established in the region. At the same time Parliament voted to allow American overflights, it also voted to send the Turkish army into northern Iraq. Ebru came to Diyarbakir from Tunceli for Nevroz.
I hope this time Nevroz will bring people, especially for Kurds and the other nations too. Everybody should dance, not with wars, but with dance they will form a unity.
But as this story goes to air, the head of the Turkish army, General Hilmi Özkök, gave his approval for U.S. overflights, meaning that tonight U.S. warplanes will be able to bomb Iraq from the north as well as the south. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Ezgi Sertaş in Diyarbakır, southeastern Turkey.
Since the attack against Iraq began haltingly yesterday, people around the world have taken to the streets to condemn the military campaign. In the occupied West Bank and Gaza, in spite of the bad weather and fear of the Israeli military intervention, hundreds of Palestinians gathered in downtown Ramallah, joining the international protests against the war in Iraq. Awad Dwabes has more from Ramallah.
In spite of the bad weather and the fear of Israeli military intervention, hundreds of Palestinians gathered all over the Palestinian territories, joining the international protests against the war in Iraq. The Palestinian message was clear in this demonstration, and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict was linked to the war in Iraq. Mustafa Barghouthi, a political analyst.
We're here to raise our voice and tell the world that the war on Iraq is in violation of international law and the Israeli continuous occupation of Palestine is in violation of international law. We don't need one more war here, especially here. We don't need one more occupation in the region.
The demonstrators carried posters of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein and Palestinian President Yasser Arafat and chanted anti-war and anti-American slogans. Many Palestinians believe that the aim of the conflict is not Saddam Hussein and that Iraq won't be the last Arab country to be attacked.
And to break the Palestinian people.
With the heavy bombardment of Baghdad tonight, Palestinians who are trapped between the conflict they are living in and the solidarity sentiment with Iraq got out of their homes once again to say no to war. I'm Awad Davis reporting for Free Speech Radio News, Ramallah.
Meanwhile, as the shock and awe bombing campaign began over Iraq, the U.S. Congress continues to work on a budget resolution for 2004. Congress has no idea what the cost of war in Iraq will be, but the president is asking for tax cuts in the hundreds of billions of dollars. Josh Chaffin reports from Capitol Hill.
Work on the non-binding budget resolution continued as the televisions reported the beginning of the campaign the Pentagon calls shock and awe. An air mission over Iraqi cities that could involve dropping 3,000 bombs. Between votes, Ohio Democrat George Voinovich put the blame on Saddam Hussein.
And it wasn't us that brought it on him. He brought it on. I'm confident that in the, what do you call it again, shock and what?
Awe.
Shock and awe, whatever, shock and awe, that it's being done as strategically as it possibly can be done with serious consideration given to human life.
Last night, the House barely managed to pass its 2004 budget resolution with $726 billion in tax cuts that the White House wants. The White House has projected a budget deficit of over $300 billion for the year, the largest in U.S. history. Some in the Senate see a conflict between cutting taxes and fighting an expensive war. Arizona Republican John McCain.
Never in history, in the history of this country, have we cut taxes and increased domestic spending when we're in the middle of a war. I'm for a stimulus package, not now.
The Bush budget doesn't include a dime for the war on Iraq, and the White House won't estimate the cost yet. Democrat Russ Feingold passed an amendment today that would set aside $100 billion from the tax cut to pay for the war.
It seems to be obvious that we should have some kind of money set aside, and it seems to me the tax cut is enormous.
Do you think that Iraq war is going to cost more than $100 billion?
My guess is it will cost more than that, but that's sort of in the middle of some of the estimates. There are estimates from $70 billion. There's even some for $700 billion.
Last Friday, a handful of peace protesters were arrested in Senator Rick Santorum's office. He's a strong proponent of the president's war.
$100 billion would pay for a lot of failing schools. You think we're ever going to get off this cycle where we coddle a brutal dictator and then we arm him and then we got to go to war to kill him?
Well, I don't think anybody can equate the money we're spending on this war to preserve basic freedoms and the money we're spending on education.
An alternative budget proposed by the Congressional Black Caucus and the Progressive Caucus failed 85 to 340 last night in the House. It would have increased spending dramatically for crises like the AIDS epidemic. The resolution now before Congress will likely underfund the AIDS initiative announced in the State of the Union speech.
We won't see any new programming on the ground from this administration until the end of 2004. 6 million people around the world will have died during that delay.
Dr. Paul Zeitz at the Global AIDS Alliance.
Already 60 million people have been infected. 20 million have already died. It's a direct threat to American security. Countries are already being destabilized, and we could be a compassionate country that is focusing on achieving global justice in the world, and that is not happening.
Senator John Breaux of Louisiana failed this afternoon to pass an amendment to cut the Bush tax cut in half. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Capitol Hill.
Yesterday, the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, BICE, and the FBI announced that teams of agents began seeking out Iraqi nationals that they said were unlawfully in the U.S. Reports last night from community organizations around the country confirmed that some 40 Iraqis have already been picked up. And as community outrage mounts over this home front assault on Iraqis, today was the deadline for male foreign nationals from Pakistan and Saudi Arabia to register with the INS as part of the National Security Entry-Exit System, or NSEERS. Several civil rights and civil liberties organizations, such as the Arab American Anti-Discrimination League and the National Lawyers Guild, have raised concerns about the implementation of NSEERS since it was launched by John Ashcroft last year. Ingrid Drake has this report from Washington, D.C.
As people began lining up in front of the INS office in Arlington, Virginia, at 5 a.m. this morning, they were met by volunteers in bright yellow shirts that said Human Rights Monitor. Those who volunteered to be a monitor said it became clear that human rights monitoring was needed after 500 Iranian men who went to register last December were arrested at the Los Angeles INS, while their friends and family waited outside. Nabil, an American citizen whose family is originally from Pakistan, describes why he chose to volunteer.
I felt that I should try to do something to, number one, offer some comfort to the people that are registering to let them know that somebody is trying to keep an eye out for them, but also to voice my protest over the policy in general.
Between 7:30 and 9:30 a.m., 27 men were let in to register. Once inside, inspectors collected data about how they arrived in the United States, where they work, and how often they wire money, and took their picture and fingerprints. During this time, 15 men were referred to investigations for either violating their immigration status or being convicted of a crime. It was not clear how many of them would be released or put into handcuffs and taken to a detention facility. Mary Harding, a volunteer from Washington, D.C., covered the morning shift and described her task.
We're very concerned that anyone who goes in comes out, and if there's any problems, that we have the information, we can find people that they want to have informed that they have had some difficulty inside and haven't come out.
Following the controversy surrounding the special registration in Los Angeles, as well as similar incidents around the country, INS officials have scrambled to make sense of John Ashcroft's unfunded mandate. According to INS official Bob Schofield from the Arlington branch, there has been a lack of direction from the federal government in how the program is to be implemented, which leads to divergent policies between INS branch offices. For example, in Miami, bond is $5,000 for those detained, whereas it is $1,500 in Arlington. Matthew Rao is an immigration attorney who regretted bringing one of his clients to the Arlington office this morning because they were detained, when he could have taken them to the nearby Baltimore branch, where they do not immediately detain people. This is what he said when asked how he would change the program.
I would scrap the system altogether. I vote Republican, but I'm an immigration lawyer, and I see that this is not really accomplishing very much. It's causing a lot of ill will, and basically it's luck of the draw what country you're from, because there are a lot of people from Central America, etc., that are in the very same situation that don't have this problem. People that came into this country illegally are not even required to report to this program. Now, you tell me how that is fair if somebody crossed the border illegally, stayed here, how they are exempt from this. It doesn't make any sense.
One man who came to the INS to post bond for his brother, who was detained the day before, talks about where the bond money goes.
They said to make a check to Homeland Security. My brother came legally, and he has been updating his visas and all the stuff, and he's applied for this, and he has got work authorization, and everything is there, and still, I mean, he was arrested yesterday.
Sarah Eltonawi, who coordinates the volunteer monitoring project for the Muslim Public Affairs Council, explained the importance of raising awareness about the NSEERS program.
There's sort of a feeling out there that we are gaining security by trading in, quote-unquote, their freedoms, these immigrants, these non-citizens. So as long as things happen to non-citizens, you know, there's less of an outcry. historically, when you allow slippages in civil rights to any member of society, then it really, really opens the door for citizens to be targeted next.
The Muslim Public Affairs Council plans to coordinate more human rights monitors before April 25th, the registration deadline for the final group of immigrants from Bangladesh, Indonesia, Jordan, and Kuwait. This man, who accompanied his friend who needed to register, said he appreciated having the monitors present, but the experience was still stressful for his friend.
He's up there and everything is going cool, but he was a little bit upset. He almost cried. But I don't have any too many friends who had to register. They were all residents. It's sad. I mean, America did change a little bit too much, I think.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake in Washington, D.C. Peace.
Water activists demonstrated at the CEO panel of the world's largest privatization companies today to demand that water be accessible for everyone. Simba Russo files this report from Kyoto.
We need water, not war. We need water, not bombs. We need water, not bombs. We need water.
In Tokyo, Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi of Japan pledged that his government would support the U.S. and its military force against Iraq. Meanwhile, in Kyoto, activists at the Third World Water Forum, where CEOs like Vivinde and Suez met with civil society organizations to discuss water privatization, staged a demonstration and walkout during the session. Al-Hassan Adam of Ghana says the report the CEOs presented would not benefit the poor.
And if you read through the report, you realize that even pension funds are supposed to be open up for private corporate bodies to use in provision of water. And that is something criminal. Pension funds are the only thing that is left for the poor people. And now that one too is supposed to be opened up for water investment through the private people. This is criminal, and this is something they are out to fight against.
Activist and writer Dr. Vandava Shiva was also present to challenge the corporate infrastructure and to provide alternative solutions to the crisis.
Development goals had already transformed the solutions to financial investment and forgotten that democracy, social regulation, people's rights are much more effective instruments in removing poverty, conserving resources, distributing them equitably. So they haven't hijacked it. They weren't designed for hijack. And public means you keep processes of water conservation, water supply, water decision making, water provisioning, water services in the public domain, under people's control. Privatization means you take it out of popular democratic control, make it costly. We have figures in India. Communities, through public services, can provide water at 1/10 the price that centralized bureaucracies can, and at 1/100 the price that corporate-run, greedy water supply mechanisms can. Because the cost they talk about is not the real cost of provisioning. The cost they talk about is the profits they want to make. And we have there's no reason why we, the earth and the people and the poor, should be bearing the burden of their profits. We don't need to. The solutions are ecological, the solutions are social.
The United Nations has declared 2003 the year of fresh water, as many say that by the year 2010, accessible water resources may run out. Critics of the UN say that this forum was a cover-up to whitewash the issue of privatization and its global impact on poor communities. Although the forum will officially end on March 23rd, advocates of public water say the fight will continue when they return home. For Free Speech Radio News in Kyoto, I'm Sandy Rousseau.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.